From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the February 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. From cooks to codebreakers. This month, we're delving into a brand new exhibition in the historic mansion, which celebrates the treasure trove that is the Oral History Project. If I was to ask you to tell me the Bletchley Park story in a nutshell, what would you mention first? World War II? Codes and ciphers? The huge strides in technology made to crack them? Or the people who did this incredible job and then kept it absolutely secret for at least another 30 years? We at Bletchley Park believe it is first and foremost a story about people. That's why the Oral History Project is so valuable, and why its contents will live on. Now, a brand new exhibition in the glorious garden room in the Victorian mansion tells some of the stories captured and preserved for future generations by the Oral History Project. In this episode, we'll bring you extracts of two of those oral history interviews. Pat Field broke Japanese codes and translated messages right at the end of the war. And Joan Ireland worked in the communications hub in Block E, using Type X machines, the British answer to Enigma. But first, let's find out a bit more about how this exhibition has been put together. Exhibitions assistant Emma Trelevan has been chatting to podcast producer Mark Cotton.
So, Emma, can you give me a bit of background for why we're opening this new exhibition and what it's about, really?
Well, we really wanted to create a dedicated space to show the contribution of veterans specifically. So we try to celebrate this all at Bletchley Park every day and everything we do, but a space that was really to kind of give some context and interpretation to all of these amazing stories that we have. And so we wanted to use kind of the oral history collection that we have and the information on the Roll of Honor and make that really, really accessible to kind of increase the presence of veterans here.
We did some of this with the off-duty exhibition last year, didn't we? Where these new ideas, like using audio points.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really, this exhibition is really to complement that. That one was really about a specific aspect of life here at Bletchley Park, whereas the Veteran Stories exhibition is about all of life. So, you know, it's not just about what you did in your spare time, but what getting to work was like, shift work, but not in the sense of, you know, how much free time it left you. It is a bit of a broader one. We have a really broad variety of people represented. So we say that we've got kind of from cooks to code breakers in the exhibition, and all the services, different kinds of civilians, everybody from kind of all the different outlying organizations as well. So we really tried to represent everybody who worked here and kind of all of their different experiences, good or bad. There were so many people working here, and they all did something completely different, and they all worked together, even if they didn't realize that they did. And I mean, we've got hundreds of recordings in the oral history collection. So just trying to make use of them, even if, I mean, we can't have hundreds of audio points. People would just get, you know, quite tired of listening constantly. So just kind of trying to edit it down a little bit. And we will be kind of changing the exhibition out every year or so to kind of feature other veterans from different parts of the site in different roles. We could definitely easily fill, you know, the mansion at the very least with stories about people.
So with this collection, I mean, it's smaller than off-duty. So you've obviously had to be really selective about what you picked this time. Did you do all the research and pick who was going in this one?
I did, yeah. I was lucky enough to just spend quite a lot of time listening to all of the interviews we have. And we do only have 3 audio points in the exhibition, but we do have a lot of quotes. So it was a wonderful couple of weeks just sitting there listening to all of these people's lives and their stories of what they did before and after and during the war. I tried to be as impartial as I could, but I do have a few favourites.
It is difficult, isn't it? You do get some where you go, this story. I mean, every story is interesting in some way, but some of them
just really capture your heart and your imagination a bit.
I mean, one of the people who features in the exhibition is a gentleman called Pat Field. And in this episode, we're going to have a longer selection of Pat's actual interview that we've taken the selection from. Not giving too much away, but he basically reads out a letter that he sent to his mum in 1944, doesn't he? And he sounds like what must have been the 19-year-old that wrote that letter, doesn't he?
Yeah, he obviously has such clear memory of what he was feeling at the time. Like, it really comes out in the way that he reads it in his interview, just how excited he was that he was in a place where, well, this or that aspect of the letter is really specific to what he was doing in his spare time, but just how excited he was to find himself in a place where, you know, it wasn't all strict military regime. It was very much kind of about social activities and just the sheer amount of options he had. You can tell he's thrilled. And, you know, near the end, he talks about his friends, that he's getting to live with people that he's friendly with. He's not amongst strangers. You can tell how excited he was at the time. It's really heartwarming. It's a really nice letter.
Is this the best part of your job, being able to find these stories and share them?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's all about how you share them as well. Like, we're lucky here that we do a lot of different kinds of interpretation. Mm. So being able to work with things like an audio collection and, you know, sourcing photographs, and then being able to, you know, do the book research as well. And then just knowing that, you know, the offices that I'm sitting doing all of this in were where these people were actually working. There's an incredible sense of place associated with doing research like this here. It's pretty spectacular. I love it. You know, it's even things like walking through the huts. If I'm wearing shoes that, you know, make a bit more of a sound, like, we have a lot of oral history about what being in the huts themselves were like, especially in the early days. And just, you know, that kind of that sound of your footsteps on the wooden floorboards when no one else is around, like, you know, like, hundreds of people experience that. It's just, they're the exact same floorboards in the exact same place as, you know, all of these people telling you about it how many years later. It's a bit spooky, but it's really lovely.
So as you say, this exhibition is going to keep getting changed up and different stories put in, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to seeing what you bring in next.
Thanks. Yeah, I get to start on the research for that soon, so it's very exciting.
Thanks, Emma.
Doodlebugs sent glass flying over the desks as Pat Field sat his final exams at school. Turning 18 in 1944, he was called up at a squeak before he ran out of time to attend the Japanese course in Bedford. From there, he went on to JAFO at Bletchley Park. Having had a classical education, he also joined an orchestra and the drama group, even landing a leading role in The Importance of Being Earnest. He told the Oral History Project he could still remember every line of that play. And he read from letters he'd sent home to his mother. But not all Pat's memories are jolly. He recalls refugees from his posting in Austria in 1946 who threw themselves in front of trains rather than be sent back to Russia. Pat's work began after the war in Europe was over.
And I'm delighted to be interviewing Pat Field, and also here is his wife Madeline. So, Pat, can you tell me, please, a bit of background, what were you doing before you joined the army?
Well, of course, I was at school. I was at school up to the age of 18. Reached the age of 18, middle of July, 1944, just the time of the doodlebugs, and left school at the end of that term. And, of course, was going to be called up immediately. It should have been immediately, although it wasn't, actually. In Sussex at Crest Hospital, which of course is more or less in the line of fire of the doodlebugs, there were times when we had to. I particularly remember when we were taking the higher cert. I'm not quite sure what modern exam that equated to, but school certificate was taken at the age of 16. And 2 years later, the higher certificate. We were sitting in big school and the warning went and we had to up from our desks, lift our housey coats over our head, because, of course, as you probably know, at Christ Hospital, we have the Tudor costume, and duck under the table, just in case anything
came over and dropped in a thing and there was only flying glass. So that was just a small interruption to one of the exams we were taking. But I was already earmarked for taking the Japanese course. Of course, I wouldn't have known anything about what it was for and Bletchley Park and that sort of thing, because one of my school friends, one year ahead of me, and his younger brother, who was in the same year as me, we were all great friends at school, particularly towards the latter part of our school years. And Michael Herzig was on a Japanese course at Bedford and was moving on to Bletchley Park. And somehow, when I must have told him in a letter probably that that sounded an interesting thing to do, and he worked out how to get me on the list, as it were. He told me who to apply to, and I was invited for an interview at Bedford in the spring of that year, probably about May, with Captain K, who was the admin officer in De Paris Avenue, Bedford. He asked, of course, the usual questions about what I liked doing at crossroads and that sort of thing. And I suppose because I had already taken and passed a scholarship exam for Cambridge earlier that spring, he evidently thought I would be suitable cannon fodder for the Japanese. So he told me that there would be the next course available would be starting in October. And I must have told him that, yes, well, I was going to be 18 in a couple of months' time in July, and presumably if I get called up in time, I could join that course. The critical thing was that they'd only just managed to call me up in time. It was very strange because when August arrived, the summer holidays, I was expecting daily a message to report, be called up, join up, and it didn't come. All of August went by. And we were getting more and more anxious because I knew that this course, the Japanese course, was going to start in October. And if I didn't get called up in time, how was I going to get there? I seem to remember my mother made approaches to the War Office, possibly through our MP or something like that, saying, please get this chap called up in time. And finally, in middle of September, the papers came through. So I only spent a very minimal time in basic army training. What should have been a 6-week course was 3.5 weeks, I think. And then I was whisked away to the Intelligence Corps depot and from there down to Bedford, just in time for the course. I was not alone in this. There was one other chap. And strangely enough, he was the other chap whom I met at my interview. He was also called for an interview that day. He came up from Bristol, and we met again very happily. It was nice to know somebody. When we joined our primary training unit in Maidstone in the middle of September. But anyway, that's the background to my learning of Japanese.
Can you remember the names of any of your instructors on the course?
Yes, of course. I mean, the chief instructor was Captain, as he was then, Eric Keedle,
thought so, yeah.
Who later became, I think, the principal librarian of Cambridge University, the Cambridge University Library, and died tragically early in about 1970.
Yes, that's right.
I remember reading his obituary and I thought, good heavens, I mean, he'd only been barely 50 years old. Captain Keedle took our main courses and he was assisted by a civilian named David Hawkes. And for character learning, we had the inimitable Captain Tuck, Oswald Tuck. Actually, at the end of our course, I remember somebody composed a little song which we sang. I can still sing it. Here's for our noble Kaigun Taisa, with one accord we Kai Banzai, sir. Our instructor, Captain Tuck. Kaigun Taisa is Japanese for naval captain. Kaigun is the navy. Taisa is a rank in the navy.
So this course was started in October, went on till...
Yes, till...
Several months, by the sound of
it. It must have finished about beginning of April, I think. And then we were sent home on leave. I think I was actually at home on leave at the time of VE Day. We were split up. I think already before the end of the course, some people had been earmarked for posting overseas. I think we probably all went to Bletchley Park initially, but several of them were then waiting to be sent on embarkation leave.
So you've did the course, had a bit of leave, and then you started in April, actually in Bletchley Park, doing the job.
And of course, it was expected that we'd be there for quite some time because nobody had any hint of the impending disaster of the atom bomb and the sudden end of the war. And I think probably we felt rather cheated when that happened.
Yes. Yeah. You'd spent all this time learning Japanese, but at some stage you had to learn how to do the code-breaking side. Was that done on the job?
Yeah. Yes, on the job. I mean, it was a big open office. The people in there, the principal translators, it was Maurice Wiles and George Alabaster, and, of course, our predecessors from one or two earlier courses who were, I suppose, able to instruct us and guide us through our initial stages. Very strangely, earlier courses, when they had got put into uniform, they didn't just stay there in uniform. They were pushed out and given commissions, many of them, which didn't happen to the later people, you see. Mm. So I was working with people who'd been on one or two earlier courses. They were, you know, Lieutenant this, and we were all just lance corporals.
So messages came in to you. These had been intercepted. They were then relayed back to the UK.
Yeah, they've been relayed back in the form of just strings of numbers. And then the first process would have been stripping the recipherment off, which was a one-time pad additive, to get down to the initial code groups, which then, in some cases, had to be recovered or guessed at, then ultimately translated.
You stayed on there till February 46.
After there was no more operational traffic coming in, there were several weeks where we were hanging around doing virtually nothing, according to my letters home. Still no work coming in. But I think they're going to move us to another section. And finally they did, I think probably not before, probably about the end of September, because the JMA section had a lot of backlog unprocessed from the earlier years of the war, because I suppose the JMA, it was Japanese military attaché in London, I suppose, but there was too much to be dealt with at the time. It was a fairly complicated cipher system. So apparently they thought, well, we might as well find something for these poor chaps to do who wrote the Japanese. So they kept us working at that for another several months.
Before we leave Bletchley Park, maybe this is a good time to talk about the sort of the domestic side.
Well, I've got here the letters I sent home just after arriving at the park. This was the 27th of April. Dear my mother, I haven't time to write much now, but I thought you would like to hear again this week how I'm getting on. Well, I think I shall like Bletchley very well. It is not nearly so rigidly military as I had expected, and there is an immense variety of recreational activities, so that I shall have plenty to do in the evenings. Thus, on Wednesday, I went to the last of five performances by the drama group of The Way of the World by Congreve, and they evidently have a very high standard. Last night, I came to the play reading of The Taming of the Shrew. Unfortunately, next week, they are reading The Importance of Being Earnest, and I can't understand the next phrase, which I really could not bear again just yet. I don't know why I said that. But no doubt I shall find something else to do. Tonight there is a piano recital by Nina Milkina, but I doubt if I shall be able to get tickets as late as this. And if not, I think there is also a show by the Film Society. Tomorrow night I shall probably go to the first rehearsal of the opera The Bartered Bride, of which an informal performance will be given in 2 or 3 weeks, after only 3 or 4 rehearsals. I might say in parentheses here that there was a scratch orchestra run by, I think his name was James Robertson, and I had semi-learned to play the clarinet at school. I had the clarinet with me, I must have had, and I played with them in the orchestra. Yes. It was my first introduction to operatic music. And later we rehearsed also and performed The Marriage of Figaro. And since then, those two have always been my favourite operas. But going back to my letter, then in a week or two, The Ballet Rambert is coming, and there are frequent gramophone recitals. Other subjects, which flourish but hold less attraction for me, are art, poetry, architecture, sculpture, dancing, and reels. As for life in the camp, it is fairly free and easy. We haven't heard anything about military training yet, and very few of us have started going to PT in the mornings, as we are not yet on the roll. I have been once only. There are four of us in my hut, Sainsbury, White House and Pennycook, and the rest are distributed among other huts, so I'm not on my own.
Do you remember, a lot of people mentioned him, Colonel Fillingham? Was that?
Oh, yes, Colonel Fillingham, yes, of course, yes.
He was commander of the camp, yeah.
Yes. Why do I think the term sculpture and art or something like that? That was his mantra.
Ah, right.
I think he was quite proud of the fact that although he was not of quite the same intellectual level as many of his underlings, he put on a lot of stuff.
What I think I've read about him, and this obviously would go back to long before you were there, was when he started, didn't have a clue what this place was all about. There were all these soldiers who were all being very unsoldierly. And I think after a while, he realised that his job wasn't to turn them into sort of fighting soldiers, but up to a point to do that, but accept them more or less as they are and provide the infrastructure to house and train and everything. And I think in the end, he was very well liked by many of them. Asa Briggs, I know, mentioned him.
Well, I think he was very instrumental in this. This is an extract from the middle of May. There is being organised here a concert in honour of Captain Tuck of Bedford to be given by his former pupils, and I am playing the piano for Michael Herzig in a Beethoven horn sonata. It's quite difficult, but I very much enjoy accompanying. And something else here I've pulled out. Oh, yes, this was November 45. Last night I saw By Candlelight, the last play being done by the Park Drama Group.
Yeah.
In brackets, the military camp one, that's Shenley Road Military Camp, the one who produced The Importance of Being Earnest, expired soon after The Importance.
Am I right in thinking you left Bletchley Park in February 46?
Yes.
And that was when the place effectively closed down, wasn't it, I think?
I don't know. I don't know how soon after that it closed down.
And then you then went off to Austria.
Yes. Well, through the winter, we were all getting impatient. What's the good of our hanging around here? We're only working on ancient stuff. Surely there should be something more interesting to do somewhere else. We all wanted to get going somewhere. And so finally we applied for and were accepted to be posted to Austria. I don't think the people in Austria really knew quite what they were going to do with us when we got there, because I remember the first thing that they said to us when we arrived was, "Can you type?" So, you see, it was a Y station, which means that it was raw signals. It was a basic signal station with a certain admixture of I Corps personnel. And they were primarily there to intercept what was coming out of Eastern Europe, and notably from Marshal Tito, who was the big bad wolf at the time. There were incidents on the frontier with Italy. Tito had ambitions to recover the area around Trieste. It didn't succeed, but it was sort of an area of tension. And also part of southern Austria, they had a small Slovene minority, which I think he would have liked to get hold of. So the intercept that came in, the set room, the chaps sitting in the set room listening, I suppose there probably was some higher-grade stuff which they had to send back to Bletchley, I don't know. But the basic stuff that came through to me and I suppose one or two of my colleagues was largely plain text from Yugoslavia. So we were scanning plain text messages saying, "Dodgy Odmach," which means come immediately. And stuff of absolutely minimal or zero intelligence value. And also some small amount of very low-grade cipher material, which we were able to deal with. When we got to Austria, they finally sent us out to a DP camp to learn languages. They hadn't got any linguists for Slovene, and so I and a couple of others of my colleagues went into this DP camp, and we had lessons with a very nice gentleman, lawyer probably. The camp was full of refugees from Yugoslavia because they were fleeing from the communist threat, and what happened
and I only heard about this years later, was I think probably, I don't know if it was after the time that I was there or before, but a lot of people were going to be repatriated to wherever they came from. I mean, there were people there who were going to be sent back to Russia or wherever. And it was a scandal because a lot of them threw themselves out of the train and committed suicide on the way, but they knew that they'd be for the chop when they got home.
Didn't you burn your chalet down while you were in Austria?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes, chalet? You mean chateau?
Chateau.
Yes, that's another story.
I think you'd better tell us now, as you mentioned it.
Well, what happened was, you see, the wire station was based at a Schloss Pfannberg, in a little village called Frohnleiten, midway between Bruck an der Mur and Graz. And we spent Christmas there. Oh, yes, Christmas Day, of course. We sat up in bed, and the sergeants came round with a cup of tea, and I think it was laced with whiskey or something, brandy. That's the Christmas tradition, apparently. And then there was going to be New Year. Now, of course, New Year's Eve is a day for great celebrations. And there were, I think, probably connected with that, the fact that several of the men were due to be going home on, you know, demob. So I had a cold, unfortunately, so I didn't go out and celebrate. There weren't many people left in the castle, but later in the evening, someone, it was across in another wing of the building, there was a fire. What had happened was, of course, it is midwinter, pretty cold in the middle of Austria. You had big fireplaces in some of the ground floor rooms, not in my room, and they had left great logs of wood probably burning. They'd gone off drinking in the village, and the wood had come out and set fire, and the whole place went up. A lot of the place went up. I've got a picture, I don't know where, I haven't seen it for years and years and years, of the results of that. And I was due to be sent off the very next day on an army course. And I thought, oh dear, this will put pay to that. I thought no problem. However, luckily, they did send me. And I got on the train and I went down to Rome for a historical course in Rome in early January. That was exciting because one of our lecturers was the daughter of Garibaldi.
Gosh.
Anita Garibaldi. She was a wonderful woman of probably age about 70. And I remember writing home to my mother saying, I never knew what a vivacious language English could be when it's spoken by an Italian, like Anita Garibaldi.
Your army service came to an end. When was that then?
Yes, well, of course, 47. Because I had got a place to go back to at university, I applied for a Class B release. That meant that I only had to serve a total of 3 years. Whereas if I had waited for my actual group to come out, I think it was group 63, I wouldn't have got back quite so soon. I didn't spend all the time at Pfannberg, at the outstation there. I managed to get away from there too eventually because I got a bit fed up with the work and I got posted to Graz. And I spent the last few months in the FS section down on the frontier with Yugoslavia, where I had the experience for the first time of living with the elevated rank of sergeants and discovering what a wonderful life they had, particularly with regard to what they were going to imbibe. Yes, there was no shortage there of good alcohol. And this led to a disaster, a minor disaster, because one night one of my colleagues there said, let's go out for a drive, took me in his little van and wandered off the road and hit a telegraph pole. And I came forward into the thing and I don't think I was actually concussed, but I had a wound in my skull and I went round after that for quite a long time with a sort of turban of bandage. And then from there, I finished up. I was only there for a matter of a few weeks. Finished up, actually, in Graz Town Guard Room, which was a strange thing. Captain Minkel was in charge there. It was a place where they locked up a few
undesirable refugees, you know. I remember one chap, he was a deserter from the Red Army, but he wasn't Russian, he was an Uzbek, he was from Uzbekistan. And I used to sit with him and get him to try to teach me some of his strange Uzbek language. I made notes of it at the time, but I lost them. I've never seen them in many, many years. And there was one dreadful time when they came to me in the morning and woke me up and said, oh, I'm sorry that so-and-so, I can't remember his name, but he was from a refugee from Romania. He hanged himself in the night.
Joan Ireland's first job in World War II was at the Ministry of Supply. It had her traipsing up and down five flights of stairs up to seven times a day as she was in a building on the embankment when the Battle of Britain was just getting underway. By the summer of 1942, she'd been mysteriously selected by the Foreign Office and put on a train to Bletchley. She had to deal with a grim billet shared with giant pigs while beavering away on Typex machines. Joan moved up the ranks, eventually seeing messages in plain text. She visited home knowing more about the progress of the war than her family did, and she couldn't breathe a word about it.
I'm with Miss Joan Ireland, who worked at Bletchley Park. What were you doing before you went
to
Bletchley Park?
My war started when I lived with my parents in a bungalow on the East Coast. When the war was declared, we were, you know, wondering what was going to happen, like we all were. But then there was a notice through the door that said, if you had no particular reason for staying there and could move away, it would be a good idea in case Hitler invaded. And my parents owned the house up here that was empty. Oh. So we got a small removal van and put the essential things in it for a week or two, perhaps a couple of months, you know. And we moved back up here in New Barnet. And after I got, you know, helped my mother sort things out, I thought, well, I need a job. So I went to the Labour Exchange and the lady there said, oh, yes, we need clerical people. We need them at the Ministry of Supply. So the Ministry of Supply turned out to be in London. So I got on the train, got off at King's Cross. Then she said, you get on a bus. You get off the bus at the Delphi House. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hadn't a clue where it was. And the bus windows at that time were all glued up with the sort of stuff you couldn't see through. However, I found my way there. This would have been about early July of 1940, wouldn't it? And when I got there, it was about at the time when the Battle of Britain started. Well, I was on the third floor of this place, great big house on the embankment, and the sirens were going off at six, seven, eight times a day. And all the people on the third floor below, that was, you went down to the second floor, down to the first floor, down to the ground floor, and then to get to the shelter, he went down two more flights of stairs because it's right down on the embankment, you see. And, I mean, sometimes we went up and down these stairs seven or eight times.
Did you get any work done?
No, very, very little. I did, however, knit a lot of jumpers and things like that in the shelters. And the other thing they did at this point was close the tube stations when there was an alert, they closed all the stations. So when you got off work, the tube station was way out the road and there was queues of people all down the road. And after a time, I think they did stop people taking cover until there was an overhead alert, which was better. But, I mean, we did very, very little work. But my parents, you see, were in New Barnet. And at this time, there was bombing, a terrific bombing in London. And they were, you know, looking across to London, seeing all these poles of smoke going up, which, of course, I was underneath everyone. You can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And in the end, My father said to me, we can't stand it any longer, you'll have to give it up. Well, after that, I went to the food office, which was just up the road. Lovely, that was. I was there for about 2 years. And I was in the milk office with the milk officer doing the children's and expectant mothers and people like that. And one day the food officer sent to me and he said, I've had instructions to take all the people in a certain year, which was me. That was the only one. But there was another girl there and she was, well, she was obviously going to be the next one. So she elected to come with me. And we both were sent a ticket, you know, on the train.
Had he said where you were going or just sort of...
We'd got to go to the Foreign Office. Yes. And they said we've got to get off at Bletchley.
Ah.
You know, that was as far as it went.
Yes.
Anyway, when we got off at Bletchley, we were very kindly ushered into a coach with the luggage and everything, coach full of girls, and we were taken the long way round. The original way round.
Right, yes.
And we went in there and we were taken to the billeting office. And then we were given a ticket for lunch. And then after that, we went back to the billeting office. And the people in there were going through a process of, you've got to go to so-and-so and giving them addresses and you get on such and such a coach. Well, this other girl, Molly, and I, we're just left sitting there. And, you're still there. And, you know, they were rushing around to get these girls on these coaches, you see. And, you're local. So we were given a name and address and just left there. Totally unhelpful people in the billeting office. So we went outside and we asked somebody who's passing by, how do you get to the Mill House Water Eaton? And they said, yes, you go up there along Main High Street, and then you turn right. Well, I don't know how far that was. I'd never measured it with a car, but oh, it was a long way.
Yeah.
It was a very, very hot day, the 1st of June. We'd got coats and travelling gear and a suitcase, and we did eventually find the Mill House Water Eaton. Oh, it was a long way. And of course, I mean, if you'd been sleeping and carrying on as normal, it wouldn't have been so bad. But you had these weird shifts. I mean, we did a 3-week shift system. 1 week we'd have gone on from 4 o'clock in the afternoon to midnight, and that was the one I hated most. And then the next, we'd come off at midnight and go on at 9 o'clock the next morning. And then at 9 o'clock, you'd do 9 to 4 for a week. And then you'd come off at 4 and go on at midnight.
Yes. And so it was only if you were coming on or finishing at midnight, you were allowed to get
the
coach.
Yes, when it was actually dark at midnight, we were allowed the coach. The rest of the time we had to walk. And I mean, it was all very well on a nice, warm, sunny day, but it was snowing. You know, you still walked it all, or pouring with rain.
Yeah.
Oh, it was a miserable place.
This was a pub, was it?
The Plough was where we got on and off the coach.
Oh, so
we
got,
no, we had to walk from the Plough.
Oh, I see, yes, I see. But it was a private house, was it, I suppose, was it? Or...
I don't think you ought to start me on the Mill House Water Eaton.
Okay.
It was a terrible place, it really was.
There's a photograph. Oh, gosh, yes.
That was the house. This bit here is the mill.
Right, oh, I see. Well, it looks very nice, but...
Oh, it was charming, charming. I mean, I felt very sorry for the people who had to have us because they were not, they're an old couple. They'd been evacuated from Guernsey. They'd arrived at the Mill House Water Eaton with two small children and their daughter and son-in-law, who was a tomato grower. And they'd just come out of Guernsey with, I mean, you can imagine, they had absolutely nothing. And then I had two girls billeted on them. It was a case of, we had the bare necessities. Just enough china, just enough cutlery, just enough bedding, you know.
Once they'd sorted out your billet, presumably at some stage they'd said, told you what you were going to do.
All they wanted to do was type. And we went to hut 14A. Well, I say we. I went to hut 14A. this other girl, Molly, I don't know where she went. I think it was possibly three, but I don't know. Can't remember. She was doing one thing and I was doing another. And she was on one shift and I was on another. And we were sharing the same bedroom. Can you imagine it? So after a bit, we went back to the stretchy billet in office and we said we couldn't stand it. Could they put us both in one place? Mm. Oh, and they were absolutely horrified to think they'd made that mistake to put us both in different places.
Yes, yeah.
Because we were sitting in the bed, you know, swapping notes.
Yeah.
They moved her over to my place within minutes.
Oh, right, yeah. So you mean at work?
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
And we were both in hut 14A, and it was chaos, really. There was sort of machines edge to edge, and there was we had those little fold-up wooden chairs and bins to put the tape in, and the stuff was all flowing about all over the floor. And don't think we were there long, and then we went to hut 14.
Mm.
Well, that's slightly better, but not a lot. And we weren't there very long. While we were there, you had to be very careful as you went out of the door on a day shift that you weren't knocked over by the lorries that were working next door.
Yes.
After a while, not very long, we were moved into this blocky, I think, you know, the cement was still dry. And that was better because we had a firmer sort of structure around us and the noise was less. You know, the decor. I mean, the floors were concrete and the walls were how the builders had left them. And the windows were frosted glass, you know, strengthened glass, I suppose. And I think outside it was some wire, a mesh or something, so you couldn't see out. In the mornings, with about 5:30, a lady would come in with a mop and a, and I don't think she had a bucket. It was one of those long mops like that with fluffs along the edge.
Oh, yes.
And if you were typing a 4Z or 5Z or something, you'd go on like this and just lift your feet up while she passed the mop by, you know. Talk about hygiene wasn't in it.
But you were doing the same job in all three of these buildings, were you?
Yes, at different levels. Mm. Originally, in Hut 14 and the beginning of Block E, I was of grade 3, and then after a bit, they upgraded you, and I went into, I was trying to work it out on the back of this envelope, I didn't get very well. That was the main big room.
Yes.
Where we typed, and the five-letter groups that we typed came out as five-letter groups.
Yes.
Another sort of five-letter group.
So it wasn't coming out as meaningful language.
No. Right. And this was the area where they did the logging. And this was the Leonard room. Now, after I'd been there, that was grade 3. Then they moved you over here to grade 2.
Right, got it, yeah.
And that was still three-letter groups both ways. But here, the interest. I say the interest, some ways it was terrifying because you got the plain language out. And they had a wonderful system of checking. When you went in, you had a little bit of paper, rather like a bridge score paper.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And you put your number at the top, 125, something you don't forget. And then you put the number of groups in the message and the number of the message.
Yes.
All night long you did that.
Yeah.
Everyone you did.
Yes.
Then you handed your paper in. Now, when you'd finished, they had all these bits of paper in. Well, if a message couldn't be decoded at the other end, it was sent back and it was sorted out who had done it and why. You see, they could tell why it was wrong, why it couldn't be decoded. You could never leave these machines untended. That was one firm rule. And sometimes they would put us in the bruiser room, which was American.
Is that BRUSA?
Yeah.
Britain, USA, yeah.
And sometimes they would put us to mind the teleprinters while the girls went on meals or something.
The Typex machines, I've seen them, you know, in the museum. They're very big, aren't they? They're big things with a big drum on each side.
Right. And you typed in the middle, and the drum that side brought out what you were typing. Mm. The drum this side brought out the code, or vice versa. Yes.
That was actual letters on the tapes.
So yeah, five-letter groups. Sticky tape, five-letter groups.
So it's not the sort of tape we think of in other machinery which had little holes in it. It was the actual letters.
Those were perforations, weren't they?
The stuff you were working on, that was coming into Bletchley Park from outside, is that right?
I suppose originally, yes.
Yes.
But the stuff that we were doing in the Leonard Room was coming from sort of Churchill. I'd say sort of Churchill.
Yes, senior people anyway, yeah.
And we could read it.
Right. So
and that was what was also frightening.
So that was plain text coming into you. And what were you doing? Were you then turning it into code?
Yeah.
Or, right.
Yes. And then it was passed through a hole in the wall somewhere in the logging room.
Yes.
And the Wrens were sitting there coding it again.
What your organisation was about was really signals were coming in to Bletchley Park and you had to sort of do things with them before they went on to somebody else. Is that sort of... but I do appreciate you probably weren't given the full picture at the time.
Well, when you were a grade two, you typed the five-letter groups... Mm. And they came out as five-letter groups, another sort.
So you couldn't, they meant nothing to you?
They're absolutely boring, and all you did was these five-letter groups. But when you got to the Leonard Room, which I did most of the time, I think, you typed what the, I say bigwigs, which you'll know what I mean. Yeah. I don't think Churchill actually gave it, but, you know, the snag was, as far as we girls were concerned, there were about 10 machines in that Leonard Room, and there were about 8 girls. Well, you only did on one shift 1/8 of the typing, but then you only did a third of the day, you see.
Of course.
So you got a bit of that and a bit of that, and you could tell whether a ship had been sunk in the Norwegian field.
Yeah. Well, whose ships were they talking about? The Allied ships or the enemy
both.
Ships? Both, right, okay.
Just information.
General information.
Above, yes.
Yes, yeah. Can I ask, why was it called the Leonard Room?
Well, the messages were called Leonard.
Oh!
There were George messages and Leonard messages. Leonard messages were the thing.
Yes.
The next one down was George.
Yeah, I've never heard that before. I'll look into this.
It was terribly, terribly important that these things went... You know, it was pain of death that you kept them waiting a minute. And when it was about 11:30 or something, there were some girls somewhere that did the logging in and out, and they come in and they say, there's a message coming through at 5Z, is anybody ready? Because you had to change the code at 12 o'clock, you see. You couldn't do yesterday's code if the message came in at 12:05.
5Z meant it was very, very...
Very, very important. Just did it, you know. Somebody had to be waiting to do it. Somebody had to be waiting to stick it up for you. I remember one sad occasion. A girl was sitting typing away, you know, in the middle of the night, and all of a sudden she burst out crying. And she typed a name of her fiancé's regimen, and then underneath she typed heavy losses.
Oh, no.
And she just couldn't go on with it. But that was the sort of, you know, the information you got. It was rather nerve-wracking, you know. It was also nerve-wracking to know that you knew what you knew.
You presumably had signed the Official Secrets Act as soon as you arrived.
Yes.
Were they constantly reminding you how secret all this was?
Occasionally... you were summoned to the Wilton Hall there and gave us a talk about how terrible it would be if we talked and all the rest of it.
And presumably, as far as you know, everybody was sensible and kept quiet about it.
No, you were almost too frightened to say anything to anybody. I mean, everybody, what are you doing, Joan? Oh, I'm typing, you know.
Yes, people must have asked you, your friends.
Oh, yes, I'm just typing. Yeah. I'm typing for the Foreign Office.
Yes.
I always remember once I went back to New Barnet and my father said, isn't it wonderful they've got Tobruk back again? And I said, yes, Dad. And I knew that Tobruk had fallen again, you know, and I couldn't bring myself to tell him. Yeah. And he died without knowing what I did. Yeah. I did try to explain it to my mother, but I don't think she quite got it.
you really were literally seeing history being made.
Oh, yes, yes. And when you were walking around these dark roads, because there was no lights, only light you got was from the moon, and you did sometimes wonder if that man over there was a German spy and come to catch you.
The work was obviously quite an intense sort of work. But
it was very intense. Yeah. But I think you could have coped with it better had you not been permanently tired. And you were permanently tired. I mean, to go back to the Mill House Water Eaton, it wasn't in a quiet road. It wasn't even in a road. It was in a farmyard, really. And there were pigs floating about. And when you came home at night, the shire horses liked to get out and stand on the top of this canal bridge that you had to go over. So you had to shoo them away before you could get past. Yeah. And I remember we tried to get leave together, but we couldn't always. So some nights you were coming down this pathway, you'd sort of stop and you could hear very heavy breathing. And you got out your number 8 battery, which was very precious. And there was a great big old sow. And then the men were coming to the mill. It's a working mill, taking the corn and bringing it back and all the rest of it. And they also loaded and unloaded Italian prisoners. When we came home on days, this other girl was a sort of pale, sort of mousy colour. And they would gather these Italian prisoners up in the area outside the mill house, you see. And they'd stand there and wait until they got them all, the guards with their fixed bayonets and things. And we had to walk along past our bedroom window to get into the bedroom. And when the other girl went in, they didn't do a thing. But when I went in, there was a fellow there, and really, it was an experience to hear him sing. And the old chap at the billet used to talk to the guards, you see. So he knew all about this chap. And he was apparently a principal tenor from La Scala, Milan. And when the dark girl went past the window, he sang these arias in the middle of the farmyard, in the middle of all these men. Can you imagine it?
Fantastic.
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. The singing was absolutely gorgeous, but was I embarrassed? Had things been different, who knows? Oh, he was a lovely-looking chap, too. Oh, dear. No, it was a funny sort of life, really. I left in April. Well, my mother had sent a telegram to say, your father dying, please come.
Yes, yeah.
So I just whipped off and left him to it. I did go back to get my things from the mill house, but I didn't go back to Bletchley again.
Soon after that, the war with Germany
I think, you know, had it not been for the fact the war was ending, they might have perhaps wanted me back, but I mean, I wasn't an only one there. Yeah.
So they were quite decent in that respect then, by the sound of it, letting you go. You know.
Well, it wasn't so much a case of letting me go as I'd gone.
You went. Good for you.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
When I left, I mean, for a while there, I was with Mother because she was in a terrible state, as you can imagine. I was a little bit worried because I was in conscription age. Were they going to call me up again? And was I going to have to go somewhere? So first of all, I went to the police station and offered myself as a teleprinter operator. Oh, they were overjoyed to have me as a teleprinter operator, which meant that I would have to be mobile within Essex. Well, I might as well have stayed at Bletchley, mightn't I?
Yes, all of Essex, yeah.
My whole point was trying to stay there with my mother, you see. And after that, I then went to work at the Brightlingsea Food Office. And then I went to the doctors to register the whole village on the National Health.
Oh.
That was quite interesting. And then I applied to do emergency training. And I went for an interview in Chelmsford. And there was about 5 or 6 VIPs, you know, sitting in a row. And they said to me, where did you work? So I said, oh, I worked at the Foreign Office. Some old chap said, and what did you do? I said, well, I couldn't possibly tell you. I'm bound by the Official Secrets Act. And I was in. That was the end of the interview. But that was emergency training. And the reason I'd gone for this teaching lark was because there was a big place opening in Clacton as a training college for teachers. But I did 2 years, and I got a job at Thorpley Soken. And then I had a job in Clacton. Now, when I was in this big school in Clacton, I did break the Official Secrets Act. I have to admit it, I did break it.
Oh, I don't think you need to worry about it now.
No, I don't think I need. The head teacher was very well organised, and she had her staff in groups, you know. And one group never saw the other group because they were on duty, you know, and so on. And her system was all upset because there was a flu epidemic and a lot of staff were away and we were doing each other's duties, you know. And I went in late for lunch with my tray into the staff room, and there were two people in there. They greeted me, but I'd never seen them before. So we proceeded with our meal, and then the chap had finished first, and he got a lump of pudding, prodded it with his fork, and he said, it's like X, the unknown quantity. She said, oh, X. She said, when I was working in Colombo, she said, my life was controlled by Station X. She said, we were always sending things to Station X. I sort of went on eating and listening. And he joined in. He said, well, I never. He said, I was on board a ship in the Atlantic. And he said, all I did was send messages to Station X. So the woman said, oh, she said, I'd love to know where it was. So I said, well, I can tell you it was in Buckinghamshire.
Wow.
Oh, dear. It was funny, really.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.